Okay, as awkwardly as possible. This is Swan Drishti, and
this is Nasa Lozano.
And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was not rehearsed, and we're awesome.
Yeah.
Our guests today are from Nomadic Press, which is a nonprofit arts literary organization supporting the work of emerging and established writers and artists. I have, my brain is dying, Dallas Effent.
Yes.
Is that how you say it? Hi,
hello,
welcome.
Hello.
And we also in the studio have Chris Needham.
Needham.
Oh my gosh.
It's
yeah.
Cool.
So,
words are hard.
I consistently struggle with names too. So I love Twitter blurbs because of you have to condense things. So Dallas is a writer, lover of cities and squirrels, and not above or below anything. Thank you for being here. And Christian Needham.
Perfect.
You're a writer and editor.
I am.
Twitter blurb. And my co-host Nasa, and we're joining you live from Radio Free Brooklyn, and we're going to talk books. First things first, we had some things we wanted to promote that are happening as we speak in Oakland, right?
Yes, as we speak, the Oakland Book Festival is going on, and Nomadic Press is going to be at Oakland City Hall. And over the course of 7 hours, we're going to have 110 readers, each reading for 3 minutes apiece. And
it's like a marathon.
A marathon of
really literary explosions, I'm sure.
Yeah. And 3 minutes each, it's enough to, you like them or you don't like them, there's another one coming.
You can hold on for 3 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not like I'm out. You can be like, well, maybe the next person will make me laugh. That's my favorite, is laughing. We met because of events you guys hosted recently, which, I mean, you guys missed out, but we can revisit the past. There was an event on Wednesday. You guys paired poets with artists. And so we went into kind of the artists' showrooms, and then a poet read their work, and then you could sit and look at art, and it was amazing. And then on Friday, you guys hosted 4 comic book artists. And then also they shared their work and then talked about their process and showed their sketchbook sketches. And so, and that was hosted in the Brooklyn Art Library.
That's right.
Which, if you have not been, this is a real thing. You get a blank notebook, you sketch in it, and then you turn it into the library, and it becomes part of their collection. And you can go and check out people's sketchbooks and, like, take them home. What a cool thing! And it's big, too. Walls and walls of all these creative things. I was, like, so excited and impressed.
Yeah. I think they said something like 30,000 of these books. Wow. Right now you can search through them, both online and in person. And
yeah.
They just moved into a new location, and we were their first real event. One of many. So we're going to try to make that a regular thing.
And you guys are hosting 3-ish events a month is the goal?
Yeah,
is that the goal?
I'd say about 3 to 4, and we switch it up. I mean, the press is really focused not just in the literary arts, but sort of supporting the literary arts alongside other sides of art. So we usually have about 1 event each month in a gallery or art space. And then we have another event where we have readings who are also accompanied by musicians. And then there's sort of like a wild card event, I'd say, where it's like either comics or...
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Coming up, one of the things that we're looking at doing is finding a literary theme to this, but actors who are in a conservatory right now, which I know you'll love.
Nace is an actor.
Yes.
I'm not in a conservatory right now, but
oh,
I was.
Sorry. I keep messing with your mics because when you talk, it goes into yours, and when you talk, it goes into yours. So I like have to be like, who's talking?
I can move this over.
No, you guys are cute. You're very helpful. Thanks.
But I think one of the things that really it comes back to is the idea of mixing the written word with the performed word. And that's something that we're always trying to find as a commonality in all the things that we do, whether it's working with artists, with visual artists who also are working with poets, or stand-up comics, or comic book artists.
I think you guys are just supporting creativity. You're like, what are you doing? Let's work with that, which is really amazing and cool.
Yeah, we're trying, and there's plenty of it in New York, so.
Really? And your next event, just a quick plug, is on Thursday, at least the one we have scheduled, Thursday, June 23rd. So make sure you mark your calendars. It's the Small Press Love Fest, Thursday, June 23rd, 7 to 9. Events, awesome. Go. Well, and I was going to say, too, what I love about your events is they're not huge yet. You go to an event at The Strand or at Housing Works, and you're going to be with a crowd of 50-plus people, and you're not going to get to talk to the presenters. Grace's events are small, and you can go up afterwards and talk to this person. I have crushes on everyone you guys have hosted so far. Crush circles are expanding exponentially. But not only get to see and be inspired, but get to touch and say thank you and, like, you know, talk over wine, which as a nonprofit, you guys ask for donations to help pay the artists and pay for wine. So really great.
Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect of it is the community, the communal aspect, especially when you have just that sweet spot of maybe 20 to 25 people in these events. And that really, for me, I mean, the first reading event that I went to since I've been here in Williamsburg/Bushwick over the last 8 years was a series that was run by my neighbor, Jamie Attenberg, who's a well-known novelist who used to run a sunset series of readings out of her apartment that 25 to 30 people would show up. They would have four or five readers, and then they would go up to the roof afterwards for drinks and to talk with people who had read and hang out. And it was a great vibe. And trying to replicate that is something that's really informed our approach to trying to do these. We'd love to have a ton of people, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think that feeling will still be present, that you're not, like, guarding or protecting people from the public. You're not, you know, they're not being escorted in with bodyguards or being protected. They're there. Like, they're there drinking before the event starts, and you get to talk to them and say hello, and they're, you know, they're around. They're accessible. Yeah. And I don't feel like you guys are going to shift. Even if the events get bigger, that's still going to be a big thing of just, like, bringing people together and having them talk to each other.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing else to consider is that we're doing three events a month. So the audience is also a little dispersed between all three events, but we're sort of like in a more the merrier kind of attitude. So we want to get as many writers who, you know, whether they've been published or not, or whether they're known or not, we want to be able to showcase their work. Mm-hmm. And we do like having those conversations after. I love seeing the connections people have made after each event.
There's sparks flying.
Yeah.
It's so great.
Yeah. It's really cool.
So I mentioned we do free write. So this is a practice I learned from Nancy Moore called river writing. So what we're going to do is today we're going to listen to this clip, which is actually one of my college professors. His name is Alex Caldiero, and this is called To Harpo Marx in Heaven. So as we're listening to the clip, you're just going to find a word or a phrase or an idea. Just try and find the thing that's standing out to you and use that as your starting spot. And then we'll write pen to the page, keep moving for 4-ish minutes. Sound fun?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do it.
Ooh, okay, here we go.
To Harpo Marx in Heaven. You no longer play the harp, nor the piano for that matter, and you speak every chance you get. But this can't be right. This can't be true. In heaven, no one has to talk, and every word is pure music. Where did I get that idea? Why do I have such an idea? Heaven? I don't know anything about the place. I don't even know if it is a place. For all I know, it's a vegetable. Yet I say it with conviction. I want to go to heaven. I pray to go to heaven. 'Cause heaven is good. Heaven is peace. Heaven is light. Where the hell do I get these ideas? I don't know anything about heaven but what I've seen in paintings and read in books. Yet I know it ain't made up. It's real. Heaven is real. Heaven is there. Heaven is waiting to house the righteous. I weep for heaven. Come take me, angels of God. Come take me up to heaven. I say up to heaven, not down. I even know the way. That's how sure I am of it. Take me up, O sweet angels. Take me up to heaven where I can play any instrument. And if Harpo won't play the harp, I will gladly. I'll keep silent and not say a word if Harpo won't. 'Cause I yearn for heaven. I call for heaven. I weep for heaven. Oh, sweet angels, take me to heaven.
So starting a free write, if you get stuck revisiting the first line that jumped out to you, or the phrase, what I really want to say is... taking the next minute or so and wrapping up your thoughts, finding a place where you can stop. A few more seconds, getting that last line down, finishing that last idea. Huzzah! We all wrote.
Done.
We all did it. Would anyone be interested in reading your spontaneous creation?
I'll read.
Perfect.
I'd love to hear what you came up with.
So I went off the line, in heaven no one has to talk. In heaven, no one has to talk. They sing and play harps, but Harpo is bored by all that. He plays pranks and runs schemes with his brothers. They show up at heaven parties, unannounced, which annoys the hell out of Peter, who has a list with everyone allowed in. The drinks at heaven parties aren't watered down, but no one ever gets too drunk, unless they want to. The dress code is all over the place. Robes, tuxes. But the music is great. ... if you like harps.
Nice. I like that a lot. Anyone else willing to share? Thank you, by the way.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I can go for it.
Yay!
The Gnostics thought there was an oppressive veil separating us from the stars. We are stars, though, souls on earth. The spirit is divided. Being human means to be split in two. If my cat eats my hamster, is my cat evil? Am I evil for having an animal that eats other animals? Am I evil for putting the priority of my hamster's life over the life of a mouse who I'd surely be happy my cat murdered if it entered my home? What is the meaning of life? The meaning of life is I have no fucking idea.
Thank you. Yay, everybody. Nasa, any interest?
Yeah, sure. Hold on 1 second. All right. After a lifetime of making light the pains of living, you can be free. There is no struggle here, no forcing yourself forward, no crying that turns to laughter because if it didn't, you would die. There is just joy that reaches down to the furthest depth and surrounds. But without pain, there is no comedy. Without struggle, no humor. Can there be a heaven for the comedian?
Thank you.
That was awesome.
I like it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And mine's a little shorter because I'm multitasking. My line was, where did I get that idea? These things we carry around as truths, a bag full of truths, but not the truth. What is true? Truth? Can truth contradict other truth, or is it able to stand alone? We know things, but how? We have rules and goals based on what? How do you build a life? How do you question the life that you're building in a way where you are asking the right questions? Where and when are the seeds planted that become the trees of reality? And how do I know these trees, climb through their branches and learn about their leaves and brush up against the roughness of their bark?
Very nice.
Yay. Thank you. I love doing that.
And it was a really interesting piece, too. Like, I'm constantly thinking about the difference between darkness and light. And so it was, like, fascinating to sort of hear, like, this struggle with what it means to be human.
Hmm.
And there's nothing like the afterlife or thoughts of it to get you thinking.
Right.
Right. Questioning everything.
Exactly.
And
constantly.
And motivations, too. Like, doing this now so that later. But what if that's not true? And what are you doing now?
Well, it also feels like in art and even in literature, a lot of why people make art sometimes is to, like, leave their mark behind.
Mm, that's so why, like, people have babies, too.
Exactly.
So, like, which accepting. Is why so often they're in like, interchangeable concepts. Like, right. This is my baby painting, and this is my baby human being, and this is my baby dog. Like,
right, right. Yeah. But honestly, none of us know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We just don't.
You don't. That's okay.
That's why, like, we did this event the other night with comic book artists, and the idea that you never know where the culture is going to go that and how it engages with art in the future. And I like the idea that with comic book art, you kind of cover all your bases. You got the words, and you got the images.
Like, oh, you don't know what a smartphone is? It looks like this, like, exactly. Or whatever. I want to shift focus a little bit to an article that you wrote that got a lot of attention, and NASA's going to kind of spearhead that one.
So I'm going to go ahead and... So the article is Report from the Field, Struggling with Creative Nepotism. So for one thing, I was particularly struck by the passage when you were talking about your own, I guess, struggles getting published in the very beginning of the article and when you had interacted with your friend. There was just a line that, like, really stuck to me. Internally, I know she didn't like my work at all. I know what a fake compliment sounds like. They're always vague and use single-syllable words. It's okay, my writing is not for everyone. And that I was just really, really touched by, because as an artist, I feel like that's something that, you know, we've all had to deal with, where it's like, no, but it's fine, because this isn't, you don't have to be on board with me on this art. This is just my art. The article itself is about picking artists more for what they bring to the table than for their name or I guess also what they bring for the table, but in a in more of a popularity or social status kind of a way. It's rather taking them in for the art,
for the content
of the work, rather than the following they bring.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of hard for me to write, because when I first wrote the article, I was scared that people were going to get mad at me, because I feel as if nepotism is this sort of secret area of literature and in the arts in general.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. It's so, like, who you know and how you're connected.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid that people were going to say that's not true, because they would want to defend the fact that if they have been promoted or published or whatever, that was based off of the merit of their work. And the thing is, I'm not trying to say that people who are well known don't deserve it. I believe everyone has something good to say. Mm-hmm. And that's what writing is for. There's everyone has a different way to live. Everyone is a different person, and we all have something good to say. So my thing is, like, there definitely is an unsaid thing, because literature is objective, and how it makes us feel is objective. It's not a quantifiable thing where we can say this is the best way to engineer this. Mm-hmm. So it feels as if, since a lot of us do want to get ahead and we are trying to get published, we are trying to get our voice out there, we all have something to say. And it feels as if, to me, like, a lot of times people have done favors for me because they thought I could do something for them. Mm-hmm. And that there's this sort of unsaid rule that if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. And I don't think we should be scared to say no to people. And I don't think people should be scared to hear no.
Yeah.
No doesn't mean that your work isn't great. It just means it's not right for this publication. It's not right for this reading. It's not right for, you know, this performance. And so I don't want, for me, especially working with Nomadic Press and booking writers, I've said no to people. I've said, you know, this reading isn't right for your work. Here we're doing, you know, something along this lines, because the gallery we're in is, you know, very sexy and, like, upbeat, and they're, like, showing bright work, and your work just isn't right for this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone should feel obligated to feed my ego, because what it does is it brings down the value of literature overall. And work is personal. Yeah. It's really personal. It's you. It's your accumulation of life. So I get why people get offended, but I think that we need to put our egos aside a little bit and just look at what it is we're doing, come up with a theme either for the reading, for the publication, for the press as a whole, and just realize that just because someone doesn't do something for you doesn't, it's no one's shooting
you
down.
Not like a tit for tat type thing.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
I think it's kind of unwritten that you know, is how you get in favors with someone is by starting with these small favors and then you can build from there. And that's legitimate. That's kind of how you start building a relationship with a person. But there's this ulterior motive thing. I appreciate you talking about your fear of even putting this out there. What was the response that you received? Because we talked about it got a lot of attention on the internet, and it still is. So what are people responding? What are the voices you're hearing? Or are you just blocking yourself off for your safety?
Well, you know, a surprising amount of people, it was 100% a positive response that I got. It was. And I sort of realized after it came out that people who were afraid of it weren't going to say anything. But that's also why I said in the article, I'm guilty of this too. When I was younger, I was first trying to get published or read or something, I thought being collaborative meant doing favors for everyone and anybody. As I got older and, you know, I was working more, you know, I didn't go to school for writing. So just putting work out there was my schooling. I really learned just from first self-publishing and then submitting things places and getting feedback. And I'm glad I published it. And I'm not trying to make anyone feel guilty. I'm really not. I'm trying to make the literary world a place that is inclusive. And I'm just trying to do my part, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important because I know, at least in the acting world, and I'm assuming it's true in the writing world as well, in school you're taught that you do have to do that mingling and that interacting, you know.
Schmoozing.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, schmoozing. I was like, what is that word? But that you do have to schmooze in order to get anything done. And it feels so fake to me. And it almost always just feels like it's kind of taking a little part of my soul away, which is the, well, I have to do this to then be able to express my art. But in your article and your life and your selections, what you were discussing is that you aren't pulling people from this who are schmoozing, but instead looking for people who are just bringing something genuine and something that needs to be heard. And I feel like that opens the opportunity for a lot of people.
In terms of acting, David Lynch talks about having people marry to the part. So sometimes people that weren't actors, and then he's like, I think everyone is an actor. But he, you know, even if someone's not an actor, if they are marrying this role, if they're able to embody this character, then that's who I want in that role. I don't want the name. I don't want this person with the credentials. I want the person that's going to marry that role. And I think the same thing happens in the literary world where not everyone is going to resonate with your work. But if you're able to get it out there, you're able to find the communities that do, and then you can help build each other.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really what we're trying to do here. I mean, the events that we've been doing with Nomadic Press in Brooklyn, we have all kinds of people mm-hmm. coming to them, and we have all kinds of people performing. Again, I'm not trying to make anyone feel guilty. A lot of people who've been published, I want to say almost everyone, absolutely deserves it. It's not about who's being published. It's about who's not being published right now.
Yeah.
That we might be missing their work because we keep feeling the need to recycle the same or promote the same people and over again.
Yeah.
So
pushing the formula that quote unquote works versus pushing diverse voices out there that are maybe not going to get as much response because people aren't sure how to respond to something. It's different, you know?
Yeah. And the struggle really is that I think most people come out meaning well, and it's a lot of work running a small publication or putting together these readings. Christian and I put a lot of work into these readings. So if you have somebody who you think is going to help sell the publication or get people out, of course you want to work with them because they're going to help you spread the word for the other people you're trying to promote. So I don't blame people. I really don't. Yeah. But I think what's happening as a result is that it feels very insular. And this isn't just literature, by the way.
Yeah.
I also am involved in visual arts, and it's across all the arts. But gaining interest is a struggle, and funding is a struggle. So mm-hmm. I get why it happens.
And it was really interesting just seeing the comment section of this Vita article. If you go down to the bottom and just seeing the conversation that Dallas was carrying on with other people in terms of different aspects of this. One mm-hmm. of the things I wasn't as much aware of was this idea of blind submission mm-hmm. when it comes to getting your work out there, and how it's essentially like the equivalent in the science world where you have a double blind study mm-hmm. where it's like, will the work stand on its own minus the name recognition mm-hmm. of an author? The other thing that was interesting about that article was two of the people that were having this conversation with Dallas that got her thinking about this was, one was Ron Olivo, the other was Bonnie Joy. And as artists, they definitely are in that inclusive area. They're both veteran artists who have a diversity of interests professionally and artistically. Very quickly, I mean, just sticking with Rana for a second, she was her Reservoir Gallery out in Ridgewood was the site of this event that we did, that Dallas coordinated and curated out on Wednesday, that was a collaboration of poets and visual artists, and giving them both an outlet to show off their work for an audience that might not necessarily be familiar with them mm-hmm. in a very innovative way. And so it really made a lot of sense that talking with these people would produce the ideas that Dallas was exploring in that Vita article.
And for listeners, you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, and I will include a link to that article in the show notes. So if you're listening and you're like, what are they talking about? Audio Boom, iTunes, Stitcher, find it, can read it, add your thoughts to the conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah, and well written. And then, Christian, you're also doing writing with Nomadic Press. You're doing a couple
yes.
of... Are they both interview format? Or
yeah, they're long-form interviews. It's transcribed interviews where I'll generally either in person, which is my preferred style, or over the phone, or in this day and age, Skype, mm-hmm. Talk to people for what I try to do, 25 to 30 minutes, just to save myself costs on transcription. Do a long form transcribed interview and start it off with an essay at the top. And really, what originally, and I had done a previous blog that did this format as well, but it was really informed by the Onion's AV Club interviews that they've been doing for years, which I thought were a really great resource. And it was the kind of thing where they kind of, when they started doing, I believe, like 12 to 15 years ago, you would just get 5,000 word interviews with really amazing people because they had the platform to attract really amazing people. I remember reading David Lynch's interview.
Mm.
And the kind of stuff where you just physically almost, no matter how interesting it was, you'd get tired out, unfortunately, at the end. And so what I tried to do was add visuals to this.
Yeah, which, I mean... I props for that, because that's one of the first thing I noticed is that it is broken up in a way that, I don't know, it's like cutting your food up. So you
exactly.
can like take a bite and then like process and digest and then continue.
Ink and Worm, carrot and stick. That's basically what it is. Trying to keep people going along to be able to stay involved with it. And the two that I head up, one is called the Talking Paper series,
mm-hmm.
which is anything that has kind of to do with books or anything that's tactile paper and people doing interesting stuff with that. And that's really hit a number of different people, whether they're authors, whether they're typography designers,
mm-hmm.
Whether they're designing mobile games that are interactive writing and imagery. There's a great outfit that I talked to the founder of, a guy, John Ingold, who's the head of something called Inkle, which had a really cool series of games which were, you basically interacted with a story as it was written on the screen with images. And so they had a series, a real successful series called Sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
And then a really successful game called 80 Days, which was based on Around the World in 80 Days, but reframed as a steampunk narrative.
Ooh.
Really cool game, won Time's Mobile Game of the Year 2 years ago. And it was primarily written by, I don't want to get her name wrong, so it's I won't try it. But it was primarily written by a woman,
mm-hmm.
the entire game, and I would love to interview her in the future. But the cool thing about it is, I only pointed out that it was primarily written by a woman, is that in one of the things we talked about in the interview also was it is a kind of a male-dominated landscape.
Yeah,
and
totally.
So that was a really cool thing. And the other night, when we, by the way, just on that note, you were there as well, Swan. Mm-hmm. The comic book artist thing was really cool. There was, I believe,
three ladies,
and it was really cool.
Oh wait, no, two ladies, two dudes.
Right, because there was co-readers as well.
Yeah, co-readers. So,
that was diverse.
Recalling the picture.
right. So yeah, that was. But anyway, yeah, like going back to that, is in the long form, I didn't want it to be too male dominated in the series of these interviews that I did. So I've tried to really overtly get a diversity, both gender and racial diversity, just to show that all these cool people and doing things with that.
And then the other series, the Kent Avenue?
Kent Avenue series is based on my building where I live and work out of. It's a famous building called 475 Kent Avenue. It's most probably well known for people who know its artistic side as being a home to very famous photographers over the last 15 years who just through word of mouth assembled there to live and to work out of there. And it's generationally, you know, people have come and gone, but I wanted to capture the stories and the talents of interviewing people who still live and work there or have in the past. And we're talking about people who work for things like National Geographic, who are work in the fashion industry, people who are work in medium format film and for the art world, and all have really incredible stories. And so I've tried to follow up with those people. And like so much else, use it as a platform to start talking about other interesting stuff. So for instance that we were talking before, one of the guys I talked to was Christo Holloway, who's a longtime brilliant fabricator of anything. He used to run a studio called Clockwork Apple out of the Navy Yards, and his bread and butter was really making things for photographic and video shoots. And he had all kinds of really interesting clients. But he was kind of like one of those guys who was, you know, when you see a final picture, there's obviously the photographer, there's the editor, but then who makes
Someone
all
made
those
that,
amazing
yeah.
things that
who
are
made
in
those
there?
Things, yeah.
So he was one of those things, and it's been really cool to talk to those people.
Fascinating. And I'll include that links to your articles in
Thanks.
The show notes as well. And then where can people find you if they're really vibing Nomadic Press and your emphasis on creating communities and giving voices to diverse artists, where can they look further?
Well, we have our website, nomadicpress.org. The website has the entire catalog of books that have been published. It also has an events calendar for both Oakland and Brooklyn. So all of our events on there. And then we also have the blog with interviews. It's a really sort of community, I'd say, built out on the website. And then we're also on all the social media channels under Nomadic Press.
Great. And then personally, individually, people can find you under your names?
Yes.
Yeah. So your site's pretty cool. I actually don't have a site of my own, but I really urge people to check out Dallas's site. She's it's really kind of a repository for all of her stuff.
It was a pleasure to browse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Add nice. My add my echo.
And one of the things that I'll also say that it's interesting to see Dallas, like most of the time my interaction with Dallas is on the written side of her artwork. She's also a fantastic painter and illustrator. And that's a really cool aspect, because it's scheduling these events. You kind of like when it comes to brainstorming ideas and stuff and the creative circles of friends that you know, the more stuff that you're into, the more talented circles that you run with, the easier it is to come up with a great event that audiences are going to respond to. So it's been a real pleasure to work with Dallas over the last year that we've been doing this.
Yeah, and really following your interests and your passions, I think. I think we were talking about like having like a cabinet of curiosities. Like you used to have this cabinet in your home and you'd be like, yeah, I'm interested in these things, and you'd showcase. And the internet's become this great sounding board where you can be like, you're interested in this strange thing too, and then you learn more about it that way.
Indeed.
So, yeah, indeed. And so you guys are mostly running events, but you work with the publishing side of things with Nomadic Press as well, or you're just hosting
well, that's
like a networking
That's an interesting point. So we do have a small press that runs out of Oakland where we release, at the moment, poetry chapbooks. We're getting into lit zines, as well as we have a children's imprint called Little Nomad.
And you said you guys are in 75 countries?
Oh, it's 15 countries 15 and 75 countries. Bookstores.
75 bookstores.
And that's something in this day and age that's really interesting, too. I went out to Oakland a year and a half ago to hang out with our founder, J.K. Fowler, and see our offices down in the Fruitvale section of Oakland. And right near there, there's a couple of really cool independent bookstores that were carrying us and also a number of other magazine stuff. It's called Issues.
Support independent bookstores.
And let me tell you, it was, you know, they maximized every inch of that space. Mm. The number of literary magazines, chapbooks from organizations across the country that were giving, they were giving an opportunity to have those independent voices. It's really an important thing. But there's the tactile aspect to that. So that's what Nomadic Press does. At the moment, it's mostly been Oakland centric.
Doing more in terms of like finding people to write books and create projects, and then
right.
Yeah, and the events as well, because they have their own location there.
And
so
they have a YouTube channel, PS, with a lot of really great readings from their featured authors that you can check out if you're interested.
Yeah. And so that's the future. That's really what we're trying to do is to, the next wave of chapbooks and stuff, is to have the New York side, the Brooklyn side.
I love the emphasis of the founder. He wanted to have both coasts, so to speak, which I mean, having come from the West Coast-ish, I mean, I lived in Utah, but that was like how I got my culture, is just like trickle over slowly from from the coast. I think there's this interesting dynamic that happens when you're emphasizing these two poles they're both creative, but creative in different ways, and we have different vibes. You know, we were talking about with your events, you have a tendency to break things up and then feature more artists, because in New York, we want more. We want fast. We're like, you know, we have this intensity that is the vibe in Oakland is probably, you know, a different feel. So finding this almost like it's like a seesaw, and you're finding the balance between these two poles.
And it's an important cultural moment, too. I mean, more and more, if you know, people are always talking about, say, in the arts in Manhattan, that what used to be the Soho area where artists could live and work. They were pushed out further east. You know, there was a cultural moment for Williamsburg. Yeah. Now it's a Bushwick. Now it's a Ridgewood. Just as much in San Francisco, which has become incredibly tough to afford to live in.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of artistic people who want to stay in the Bay Area, moving over to Oakland and going to these areas to try to develop communities. And so that's another part of the duality of it between Oakland and Brooklyn. And what we're trying to develop there.
Yeah, let's keep artist communities artistic. You can live there. You just have to, like, create things and make things.
Yeah.
I like to end my shows, we're actually getting close to that time, with a rapid fire, which is a series of questions kind of geared towards your literary experience.
Nice.
If you're game.
Sure.
So my answer is different every week. It's so funny. What book have you not gotten around to reading?
Infinite Jest, and I never will.
I don't think I will either.
Yeah, I have no interest.
And every time I say that, people try to tell me how epic it is and how, and I start to like glaze over and daydream about who knows what. I watch, my guilty pleasure is watching the BBC David Attenborough nature series.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like listening, but thinking about polar bears climbing ice.
Right.
like, that sounds great.
Mine would be Neon Bible, which was the follow-up to Confederacy of Dunces. It's the only other thing that's that John Kennedy Toole wrote.
Yeah. Nasa, do you have a new book you haven't read?
I have so many. I guess my newest one, it might actually get me yelled at, but it's fine. Pride and Prejudice. I keep starting it, and then something happens, and I have to put it down. I've done this like 10 times in the past year. So
I've never read it either.
Thank you.
Right?
I feel like everyone expects it of you. Like, you're a young woman, you need to read this book. And I'm like, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's definitely a formative book, but I didn't. It's a thing. Some people just swoon over it. And I was like, it was readable, but it wasn't like I want to live their lives. I can't think of a book that I haven't gotten around to reading recently. So maybe that's good. Maybe I'm reading all the books. Is there a book you remember your parents reading to you?
Good Night Moon.
Yay! That one's the best.
Little Cabin in the Deep Woods. And my mom's twin sister, when she was growing up in the 50s, wrote Laura Ingalls a letter and got a response.
Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah, write letters, people. If you have a crush on someone who's alive, write them a letter. That's like something I've been emphasizing in my life. I mean, you never know who's going to respond, but also just being able to vocalize your appreciation. For me, that has so much value of just being able to say thank you for this thing that has changed me.
Like it's a Twitter thing.
Oh, Twitter's totally that.
Like so many people just like at their favorite artist and then they get a response.
And they respond and oh my gosh, that's I don't fully understand Twitter as a thing.
I don't either.
People keep responding in a way that's like, oh my god, this person now knows that I exist. Or at least they did for that moment. Like
so and so retweeted my joke.
I know.
Like, I don't know if that's an amazing moment, a great moment. Like congrats.
Yeah. It's definitely changing the social landscape of our world.
Especially now that the Pope is on Twitter.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, can you imagine?
At the Pope, people. Like, come on, let's tweet the Pope.
Is that his tag,
no, I don't
at
think
the
so.
Pope?
I don't know what the Pope's
tag. Find out that tag. Because if you're Catholic, I mean, that's pretty much it, right? Right.
Can get a call back from the Pope. Right. Do you have any rituals or routines? And we'll open it up for art, but, you know, writing.
Drinking and then doing things I regret not while drinking separately, and then I'd say that's it.
You're like, there's always this catalyst moment where I'm just like, oh, I've stooped so low, now I can write about it,
right? Like, I usually go through like a 3-month period where just nobody should know me, and then something really great comes out of it, I think. I hope.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
You've got to transmute.
Leaving the house every day, which it seems simple, but the last year or so, I've been working as a marketing writer from home, and it has completely changed my socializing with people. And so it's enough to leave at one point, hopefully in the morning of the day, to go out and do something, take a laptop with me. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a coffee shop, but just going out and talking to people. And it's amazing during the work week, talking to someone, having those interesting conversations you wouldn't have otherwise. But it gets me, definitely gets me inspired to, after I'm done with that, to sit down and to get writing. And doing it with music, too. I also like playing music while I write.
See, that's something I'm getting better at, but if I'm in a noisy space, sometimes I'll get fixated on the noise. And so music is helpful in that sense because then you can focus on that. But
with words, you can ignore. That's an important aspect too.
Yeah, mine's always instrumental. As my river writing music's always sounds, not words. So I've noticed that there's a book people read at some point during puberty that changes them. It's like, I was a child and then I was exposed to this thing and was like, oh, there's this whole other world. I'm different now. Is there a book that did that for you?
I'm going to get a lot of hate for this.
No, no hate.
The Fountainhead.
Oh, nice.
But just nice. Hear me out. Yes, I did. Oh, yes, I did.
It's like required reading, I think.
The thing is, like, in a political sense, in a social justice sense, nobody should ever consider Ayn Rand's thoughts necessarily. But in an artistic sense, the dedication of doing what's right for your work really came out in that book for me. Okay. So I think, like, it became this thing where, like, I read it and I was like, I get this as an artist. Not as a human being, but as an artist.
When I was 19 and in college, I took a course that they gave us a book called Born for Dead by a woman named Lori Gunst. And
Born for Dead?
F-dead, F-I. Uh-huh. It's all about... She was in Jamaica, and it's a history of Jamaica along with her interactions with gang members down there.
Oh, wow.
And it's a great investigative piece. And through that, I've read it now probably 20 times. It's a great read for anyone that can find it. And through her, I met a guy named Thibaut Erengart, who republished it in France, in French. He, for about 10 years, ran a reggae magazine in in France, and now is working as a run something called Dread Editions, which is a whole series of books that are focused on Jamaica. And the reason the book really touched a nerve on me was I didn't know hardly anything about Jamaica. Did grow up in the New York City area during the 80s into the 90s during the crack wave. Even though I was lucky enough not to live in those neighborhoods, that a lot of this came in the wake of Jamaican gangsters who had moved from Jamaica, where they had really come of age serving as muscle during these really contentious elections, to the New York City area and really staking out territories right here in Brooklyn, in Queens.
The rich history that everything is built on.
So that it was like reading about something that I was kind of only a little bit aware of, and then making a connection with it. And then I was really lucky years later, about 5 or 6 years later, to interview Lori, who's a fantastic, fantastic person. If you guys can find, she has another great book called Off White, which is about her being her growing up in the South, half Jewish, half Black.
Oh yeah, you were talking about that earlier today, or no? Is that something else? Never mind.
I'm sure. Oh yeah, who was I talking about?
Well, that's. I don't know. I'm gonna check her out though, because.
Please do. Yeah, she referred me also to in that same thing. She referred me to another author that I was also aware of. We got a chance to talk about a guy named Walter Mosley. I don't know if you guys know.
I've heard
know
of him. Walter Mosley.
Great crime writer, mm-hmm. Very prolific, has multiple character stuff. He's half Black, half Jewish. Really, his Easy Rollins series is a great kind of episodic look at the history of Los Angeles and through the eyes of this private eye over the years. But those two people, incredible voices. Thibault, who is their publisher in France, still doing incredible stuff. But it's this small island down in the Caribbean that's had such a big cultural impact positively. The crime side is a small side, but the music and culture and the amazing people that come out of that, it was something that really affected me reading that book.
Nice. If I were to visit your homes right now, what books would be showcased? What would be eye level, sitting out?
I have I Don't Poem on my main coffee table in my living room, and that is a book put together by Black Square Editions, which Rana, who was mentioned in the Vita article, she was part of putting that together. And it's a bunch of poems by painters, and then you actually can fold out the pages and see their paintings as well.
Ooh, nice.
It's really cool.
I also have that same edition. I'm glad to have it. And, working with Nomadic Press, you pick up a lot of the works of these people, these amazing artists that you work with. So Rana Lebo, definitely her work. Jeremy Nguyen's, his book, tactile book versions of his Stranger Than Bushwick comic series. He's the in-house cartoonist at Bushwick Daily, a genius. He's really,
yeah, very clever.
Check them out. So I have those kind of outwardly facing on my shelf. And then another one of my favorite ones that I've read and lent and gotten back a couple times is a little book called Bushwick Nights that was edited by Dallas Athens, and it's stories of Bushwick that she did when she was working with Katrina Hypanova over at Bushwick Daily. And it's a really, really great cross-section of artistic expressions, of stories of this really amazing artistic part of Brooklyn.
Cool. One more question. Do you have any secret addictions to like a podcast or a Netflix series that like comes to mind?
Every single Netflix show that ever comes out. Basically.
Oh.
Like, I love all of them.
You're just, like, nonstop.
Yeah, like, House of Cards, Orange is the New Black.
Oh, the ones that they, oh, yeah, yeah. They're like producing really, really cool stuff.
I love Masters of None. That's one of the ones.
Yeah. They're just all so well shot, have such compelling characters.
Nice.
Amazing.
Thanks, Netflix.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm going to a YouTube series that's very television-like. It's from an outfit called Red Letter Media, and they do a great series. They actually kind of came to the cultural mainstream. They did a 90-minute takedown of the Star Wars films, like the Phantom
Menace
and stuff.
It sounded familiar. I think I've heard of that.
They're a really cool collective out of Milwaukee, and they do a great series of old bad video things called Best of the Worst. Really worth looking at, and where they basically put bad movies on a wheel called the Wheel of the Worst, randomly take them and then watch them and review them. And they also do a great movie review thing called Half in the Bag, where they go through and review this stuff while they drink. But it's if you guys get a chance to, it's headed up by a guy named Mike Stoklasa, who's a really really funny, really thoughtful filmmaker out of Milwaukee.
Nice. You've been listening to Ink and Worm, All Things Reading and Writing. Thanks so much for being here, Dallas and Christian. Coming up next, we have Empty Orchestra, exploring karaoke with Angelica and Amanda. I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it, Petencore.